Welcome back to Across the Movie Aisle, presented by Bulwark Plus. I am your host, Sonny Bunch, culture editor of The Bulwark. I'm joined, as always, by Alyssa Rosenberg of The Washington Post and Peter Suderman of Reason Magazine. Alyssa, Peter, how are you today?
I'm swell.
I am happy to be talking about movies with friends.
First up in controversies and non-controversies, The Bob is dead. Long live The Bob. Before we begin, I just want to set the scene. Sunday night, I've had a few glasses of wine, and I look down at my phone to see a text message from one Peter Suderman, and I was like, oh, that can't be right. This can't be. Certainly, Peter has fallen for one of these fake blue checks and sent me a fake tweet from a fake Brooks Barnes account. But no, it was real. It was real. What did this tweet say? Quote, big Disney news, the Walt Disney Company, NYSE, Diz, announced today that Robert A. Iger is returning to lead Disney as chief executive officer, effective immediately, end quote. It was amazing. I've never really seen anything quite like this before. The head of one of the biggest media companies in the world fired via press release that sent every trade publication and every newsletter author and every podcast host scrambling to their laptop. Bob Chapek following a bad few quarters and an earnings call that one person who follows these things pretty closely described to me as psychotic was out. His predecessor and the guy who handpicked him for the job, Bob Iger, was back in. And I don't think Bob Iger planned it this way, but it really is just an amazing bit of timing. Iger leaves the company right before COVID-19 hits, which shuttered movie theaters and the theme parks and the cruise lines. It just messed up every aspect of the Disney business. And he's coming back a little bit before the company plans on Disney Plus becoming profitable. It lost a lot of money in the last quarter. It should be headed towards profitability next year, late next year at some point. All of which is to say that Chapek got dealt a bad hand, and Iger was at least the dealer for some of those cards. He was the one who engineered the push into streaming. He's the one who created Disney's addiction to Chinese box office dollars, which have taken a huge hit. He is, you know, not done. He did not do well by Chapek exactly. He was also behind the scenes, kind of hanging around, saying, hey, you know that new guy kind of sucks, doesn't he? Maybe we could bring back me. But let's be fair to Iger. He is the guy who remade the company into what it is today. He engineered deals to acquire Pixar, Marvel, Star Wars, 20th Century Fox. He's the guy who created the only real Netflix challenger, at least in terms of size, with Disney Plus and the Hulu ESPN Plus bundle. And he's the guy that shareholders trust to right the ship, because the CEO's real job isn't to decide what movies go to streaming. It's not to decide which movies go to theaters. It's not to figure out what the proper price point that you gouge your theme park goers is, right? It's keeping shareholders happy. That's what the CEO's number one job is. And Chapek was freaking them all out while Iger was, again, kind of behind the scenes like, hey, you kind of want a steady hand on that till right now, don't you? What about me? So Iger's in, Chapek's out, stock market responded as we all thought it might, with shares up 9% in pre-market trading. Peter, have you seen anything like this before? This is the craziest thing that I can remember seeing happen in the business of Hollywood in a long time.
So outside of the business of Hollywood, you can definitely think of some examples that are not exactly the same, but are comparable, such as Steve Jobs coming back to Apple after some time away at Next. Schultz at Starbucks, who's been CEO there like
Howard
three
Schultz.
Times,
Howard Schultz, yeah.
I think.
Yeah.
Howard Schultz. I wanted to say Charles.
Not Charles Schultz, not the
little
creator
different.
Of Peanuts.
That would be great if he had been the CEO of Starbucks. But he has moved back into that role several times. But this is pretty weird.
It's wild.
This is just bizarre. I mean, it's pretty obvious that Bob Iger was just quiet quitting this whole time. I want them to make a movie about this and call it What About Bob 2?
I mean, it's crazy. It really is crazy because, like, if you read as many industry newsletters as I do, and I read a lot of them, everything that you hear in these newsletters was saying the same thing about Bob Iger, which is that he was behind the scenes all the time talking to people and being like, hey, you know, I'm still around. I can help out with these tough times.
Which is weird because when he left abruptly, much earlier than he was supposed to. And so if you recall, he left in February of 2020. That was 1 month before COVID hit the United States. Now, it's pretty clear that he left in part because he didn't want to deal with whatever COVID was going to be. I don't know how much of a sense he had that COVID was going to become this thing that shut down, you know, the movies and theme parks for basically for a year, if not for longer. But he certainly was aware that COVID was going to be a big deal because he was a guy who oversaw Disney theme parks, which meant he oversaw Disney in China. And he had that, like, he knew what that was going to be like months before. I think a lot of people in the United States had really picked up on what a big deal that was. And I think, you know, it's never been entirely explained why the exit email in February of 2020 said effective immediately, even though he had been expected to stay on for a couple of months. But I think you have to imagine that COVID was something that he was just like, nope, I'm out. I don't want to deal with this. And so he left and then didn't deal with it and left it to his successor, who the reporting on like how his successor, Bob Chapek, Bob 2, was picked is that, like, on the one hand, Bob Iger picked him. And then on the other hand, Bob Iger didn't like him and thought he was a bad successor. And I confess it's a little bit muddled. It's obviously, you know, sort of going all of the reporting. I'm not suggesting that it's like that it's, you know, wrong or that people are sort of making too much of it. But like it's all going through a kind of Hollywood gossip mill, right, that just sort of makes it hard to know exactly what happened there. Part of the problem, though, is that Bob Iger, if you can say a lot of good things about how well he managed Disney before he left, right? He really did build a big, effective business. He successfully built out the China market, even though, I think there was, we can talk about the costs of that, but like that was a good business play, at least in the short to medium term for them. He bought Star Wars and Marvel to achieve his goal of, I think that the phrase he used was cornering the market on franchisable IP, right? Like he really took Disney like in a new direction, made big, bold choices, and they paid off. But he did not plan his succession well. And that is, frankly, like not a great sign for someone who is coming in for what is, I understand, to be a 2-year contract, during which he's going to have to pick a successor.
Yeah.
Again.
Yeah. We'll get back to that in a second. Alyssa, do you think, lizard brain, in the lizard brain part of me that is always kind of looking at how this could be bad for me personally and also America. Do you think that this was a backdoor way for Disney to get back in China's good graces? Because I do think that I think losing access to the Chinese market for their films has been very, very bad for them. And they worry about losing access to the parks that are there, which would be even worse.
Man, I don't know. I mean, I think that part of what's happening in China is so driven by, you know, ideological considerations there that I don't know that this is a matter, this is something that Disney or Iger can particularly massage, right? I mean, it's been fairly clear in recent years that, you know, China saw itself as letting in these Western movies. And I think Western executives thought that they were like, that this was, you know, going to be part of a larger narrative where economic opening leads to political liberalization, that they were sort of going to conquer this market. But China always kept a cap on these movies. And it seems as if this was an attempt to, you know, get audiences accustomed to going to certain kinds of blockbusters, buying time for China to start building its own homegrown blockbusters, and then kicking the U.S. out, taking that market share back. And in fact, China has had box office hits, including some that have like sort of traveled abroad modestly in Asia with sort of nationalistic blockbusters, largely around sort of Chinese military exploits. You've had one, The Wandering Earth, that's a science fiction movie. But, I don't know that this is about like playing nice with the regime or personal relationships. You know, I think that China would very much like to, among other things, sort of counter Korea in what it perceives as its cultural sphere of influence, that, you know, it was fine to have American audiences going to the sort of very specific, the specifically edited local versions of Hollywood movies for a while. But I don't know that there was ever sort of a long-term intent to gain market access. And I think the relationship between the two countries has become so tricky that, you know, I don't know what Iger could do to woo the Chinese government that would not attract some scrutiny from U.S. regulators, right? Like, I don't know what the narrative or the play is.
I also think that China's government used Disney and specifically an American movie studios generally a lot the same way that Netflix used Marvel. So Netflix realized that they needed recognizable properties, and Netflix built out a whole little mini universe of Marvel IP before Disney Plus existed. And it was sort of vaguely kind of sort of connected to the movies, but not really. And so stuff like Daredevil, right, and the Luke Cage, that sort of thing. And the idea was that they could leverage that into something else. And then Disney, of course, decided to take it back because they saw, oh, we're losing out on this. But China, in some sense, looked at Disney and looked at, you know, U.S. film production and said, oh, let's take that and use that, use somebody else's material for a while we build out our own capacity. And it's not clear that at this point they want to go back to using somebody else's material. Maybe if the terms are favorable enough, maybe if they think they can get something out of it, but it's not obvious what they would get out of it, because I think the Chinese government's whole goal always was to kind of eventually insource and build a domestic film production capacity, and that Disney was just sort of a temporary solution while they built that up in-house or in-country.
The Chinese government's COVID zero policy has, you know, persists, you know, not just because of sort of trauma that came out of the initial Wuhan outbreak, but because it's become a fantastically convenient way for the Chinese government to expand the surveillance state and to instill what are effectively sort of habits of compliance in a population that has put up with stuff that, you know, unlike the, you know, comparatively mild COVID prevention measures in the United States, you know, if the Biden administration or the Trump administration tried to shut down an entire city for a month on end, like not letting people leave their apartments, there would be an actual armed revolution in the U.S. And, you know, China instead has used that to really narrow the sphere of control. And, you know, cultural control for China is not just, you know, there are laws limiting the number of hours that people under 18 can spend playing video games, right? And, you know, like facial recognition sign-ins. There are, you know, subjects that are completely banned. Chinese box office recently has been bad, you know, and there have not been movies that have been big draws. But, you know, I don't know what the Chinese government sees itself getting out of, you know, Hollywood movies at this point.
I don't think this is about China.
I think this is about the
U.S. macroeconomic situation and the expectation that there's either going to be a recession or at the very least a lot of consumer cutbacks, especially when it comes to subscriptions and media. And the ad market is really, really soft right now. If you've been following the Warner Brothers, Zaslav there is just like the ad market is a total disaster. And then in addition, streaming is not paying off for anyone right now. And so all of these companies have invested a huge amount of money with the intention of losing money in streaming. It's not like this is not exactly going to plan. At the same time, the plan was to lose billions and billions of dollars.
Yeah.
And that plan looks maybe like a less good plan when you're heading into what a lot of people expect to be a recession. And the board simply did not have the confidence, the shareholders simply did not have the confidence in Bob Chapek to lead the company through turbulent economic times. Bob Iger looks like a safe choice to them. And so Bob Iger, who had been hanging around saying, hey, you know, I'm still available. I got a lot of free time.
I'm yachting around, I'm making money with Jared Kushner, but like, you know, if you needed me, call me.
One thing we haven't really discussed, and one thing, frankly, that is slightly beyond the purview of this show, but is very, very important here, is the actual parks operation. And I will say that, you know, look, it's not a thing we talk about a lot because it's not really, again, what our area of expertise is. I will say that when I mentioned having gone to Disney last in the spring, you know, I talked about taking my family, and I heard from a bunch of people who were like, God, it's too bad you couldn't go like 3 years ago, you know, before COVID, when everything was so much better and the fast passes were better. And now I will say that from my perspective, as a parent who was taking a family there for the first time, it was great. I had a great time. It was really well run. Everything, there weren't a bunch of breakdowns. Like, everything seemed to be going okay. But I will say that I have heard repeatedly from folks over the last 6 months or so, like, the park situation is dire. Like, we go all the time. It is much worse now than it was. They are nickel and diming us to death. They are making us spend more money than they ever have before. And the quality of the experience has decreased.
Yeah. So Chapek comes from the parks business before he was in the top job, and one of his decisions was post-COVID, he was going to basically stop serving the regulars and instead attempt to extract as much money as possible from, let's say, from fairly rich families who don't go as often.
Yeah.
And so rather than building systems for people who are going to spend a lot of money but go a lot, for sort of hardcore Disney fanatics who just make Disney their life, he decided that he was going to reduce the number of total people allowed in these parks and then also institute just sort of a system of like nickel and diming fees, but like quite expensive nickel and diming fees, almost a lot of the sort of thing that you sort of hear people griping about with airlines, where every single little, you know, sort of, oh, you get 4 extra inches of legroom, that'll be another $92, and it's just all priced in. And he did, in fact, as I understand, succeed in bringing in extra revenue this way. Like, it was just from a sheer short-term dollars strategy perspective, it was pretty effective. At the same time, the people who loved Disney loved it less as a result. And so Disney is not just about, you know, making extracting as much money as you can in the short term. Disney does have a brand to protect. And it's not obvious that Bob Chapek was doing a great job of protecting that brand, whereas Bob Iger, whatever, again, you can complain about his China moves, you can complain about a bunch of stuff that he did, but Bob Iger built and expanded and deepened the Disney brand over the course of his 15 years at the top of Disney and was really pretty successful at it.
Yeah. And I mean, we heard from a longtime listener to the show, friend of the podcast, who said, you know, his family has been to Disney 20 times and now would not go back until some of the changes, like the, you know, exorbitant fees for sort of line skipping, are rescinded, because it feels miserable.
Now, I will say I had a very good time there. So I'm like that, the target, you know, the like, upper middle class to upper class, you know, family that's coming in once every 2 years for a vacation. I don't really mind spending a little bit more, but I could.
And what they basically figured out how to do is to take the Sunny Bunch class of people and get another $200 out of them. And over the course of one trip, it's a lot of money, but it's not like, man, I'm doing this every weekend. Whereas the people who are going every weekend are really mad now.
Once you have that sunk cost of, like, I'm here, I've paid for the tickets and the flight and everything, like, it's you know, the most valuable thing you have is time, and spending a little bit of money to save money is worth it. All right. Again, fascinating story. I'm very curious to see if Iger, you know, tries to pick up a new company. People were like, well, what if he tries to buy Netflix? I was like, I think Netflix is possibly bigger than Disney at this point, which would be make it a pretty hard sale there, but
certainly
we'll
their content spend is bigger.
Yeah.
I think
the
big thing that he could do that would make waves, certainly for our podcast audience and for us, is that he is going to try and fix the Star Wars feature film franchise, and that might mean moving Kathleen Kennedy out of the Star Wars overseer role.
Maybe it'll mean we will get something that is better than just kind of fine, like Andor, you know.
Make Tony Gilroy like your in-house Kevin Feige.
Because Andor is great.
Andor is fine.
Not just
it's fine. It's so good.
Fine. And Tony Gilroy is the only person who understands Star Wars.
It's okay. Besides, it's very okay.
As the person who, like, people were scandalized that I had not watched Andor, I have now watched half of Andor. Peter's correct. Sonny, as always, is wrong.
No.
And we should go on to the feature.
It's perfectly fine. I like to watch it when I'm at the gym on my phone. That's when I watch Andor. It's great. Perfect timed. Entertainment for my elliptical / exercise bike. All right. So what do we think? Is it a controversy or a non-controversy that Bob replaced Bob in A Midnight Massacre? Peter.
Your opinion about Andor is a controversy. This is obviously a controversy. This is an insane story. This is like the biggest media company in the world. And they're just like, oops, we're going to do backseas on our CEO succession plan.
Alyssa.
Controversy.
It's definitely a controversy. And again, I literally thought Peter had been fooled by a fake Twitter account when he sent me that tweet. I was like, that camp, I got to make sure this is the real Brooks Barnes. Turns out he was. So
I don't do fake news.
Real news story. All right. Make sure to swing by Bulwark Plus for our special bonus episode. Last week's on children's books was great. By the way, you should go listen to it if you haven't. Go read the comments. Many, many great suggestions from listeners like Gina, Michael. They were leaving great recommendations. Thank you for doing that. Go check them out. This week, we're going to be discussing some of our favorite movies about food. You'll have plenty of Thanksgiving leftovers to pick over. We're going to talk about foodie cinema. It's going to be great. Now on to the main event. The Banshees of Inisherin, Martin McDonagh's latest. It stars Colin Farrell and Brendan Gleeson, who worked with McDonagh on his masterpiece In Bruges. Banshees is set on the fictional island of Inisherin, just off the mainland of Ireland in 1923. It's during the Irish Civil War. Rifles and cannons can be heard in the distance as Farrell's Patrick. I'm just going to call him Patrick. I'm not trying to do the Irish pronunciation of this. Walks his animals about the island while Gleason's Colm tries to have his beer in peace. Just wants to be left alone. He's tired of Patrick. He doesn't want to be bothered by this slightly dim, friendly but dim man anymore. He just wants to work on his music and create something that will live on long after he's dead. And Patty's yammering has left him unable to do that, as the trailers reveal. Colm tells Patrick that he's going to cut off a finger every time he bothers him. I don't think I'm spoiling too much to say that he follows through on that once a little bit. Kind of gives new meaning to the phrase, cut off your nose to spite your face. But here we are. The dilemma that McDonagh has crafted here is kind of fiendishly clever in its simplicity. Friendships end all the time, but they rarely end abruptly and for no good reason, or at least a reason everyone judges to be insufficient. Patrick didn't insult Colm. He didn't injure him. He didn't, you know, pour sugar in his mother's gas tank. He's just kind of boring. And Colm doesn't want to be around a boring person anymore. It's a deeply and darkly funny movie, which is aided by the fact that it just has a top-flight cast. And in addition to the lead, you've got Barry Keoghan as the village idiot who has a sort of twitchy vitality to him. And then Carrie Condon, who is doing, I think, I've loved her since Rome. I think she's doing career best work here as Patrick's long-suffering sister. It really is the most Irish movie of all time. The Banshees of Inisherin, starring, you know, Colin Farrell and Barry Keoghan. I just can't imagine a movie any more Irish than this. The film is set against the backdrop of the Irish Civil War, as I mentioned, and I'm sure there are many parallels between that conflict and the Cold War between Colm and Patrick that experts in the field of Irish conflict will be able to work out. I don't know any of that, so I'm going to leave that to them. I will say, however, that the movie called to mind some of the talk that you hear occasionally of national divorce, right? You sometimes hear folks on the far left and far right say, especially on the far right, they're like, oh, you know, America just needs to amicably separate. You know, we're too different now. We don't have anything in common. We'll go over here. You go over there and we'll all go our separate ways. But one thing that the Banshees of Inisherin does is it reminds you that such divorces aren't really possible. I mean, there's always going to be hurt feelings. There will eventually be violence. National divorce isn't a thing. It's just not a thing. But civil war is a thing, and civil war is ugly, self-damaging stuff. Alyssa, what did you make of the Banshees of Inisherin?
I admired the performances in this tremendously while being somewhat irritated by the thudding obviousness of this movie. I mean, there's literally a moment where the characters talk about how banshees are no longer like running around causing havoc. They're just sort of watching people destroy themselves. And then you have like a sort of creepy old lady who wanders around being like, bad things are going to happen. I'm walking along the beach with a hook. It's like, oh, here's your literal banshee of Inisherin. You have a sort of exhausting metaphor for the Irish Civil War, which is, you know, Colm's decision to just become radically intractable all of a sudden, and then literally to commit repeated acts of sort of self-defeating violence, right? Like, he's literally cutting off the fingers that allow him to play the fiddle that is ostensibly the thing that he wants to spend the rest of his life doing, right? And, you know, Patrick is presented as sort of like this, you know, kind of an innocent, right? He's, you know, he's dull. He clearly has, you know, a temper. He burns down Colm's house at one point. But he, you know, he's like this sort of simple person. He doesn't know why this is happening to him. And just like, I mean, I'm not an expert in the Troubles. I am, you know, Irish on my mother's side. My middle name is Bennett. And so just as someone, you know, who has read about and is interested in this to a certain extent, the sort of, you know, heavy-handedness of it as a metaphor was just felt really tiresome by the end of the movie. And again, like, scene to scene, beautifully written, scene to scene, tremendously acted. But as a whole, it just totally lacked the sort of subtlety and surprise of In Bruges for me. And I love that movie. I love In Bruges. I think it's tremendous and surprising and just deeply moving. And I did not feel that way about this movie. I mean, I think that I totally agree with you about the character of Siobhan, just beautifully acted. And as the person who's like, who's thinks she's getting out, but is actually headed to the mainland where the conflict is, and in fact will continue for decades to come. I mean, it's just, you know, poignant and, you know, sort of, it's the most interesting and sort of subtle point about the limits of the possibility of escape, right? Like when you, you know, when you're in a societal dynamic, you can pit yourself up and leave, but you can't really depart. But I thought the movie was just too on the nose to really feel transcendent to me.
We live in a society. That is the lesson of this movie. Peter, what did you make of Banshees of Inisherin?
I loved this movie. And I liked the fable-like, not quite play-like, but almost play-like nature of it, right? Including the creepy old woman who calls to mind the witches from Macbeth and sort of seems to be there as a specter, right? As, yes, in some ways a literal banshee, but she's haunting this movie. And this is a movie about the ways in which, you know, human relationships are haunted. And I guess I did not see this as a thudding metaphor for the war. I felt like it was actually working in reverse, where the war was a metaphor for the people rather than the people being, you know, sort of a stand-in for the larger socio-political, cultural conflict of the war, right? There's that bit at the very beginning of the movie where Colin Farrell's character, he's walking across, you know, at the island, and he sees gunshots across the water, and he says something to the effect of, good luck with whatever it is you're fighting about, right? And the point is, to some extent, that it's totally irrelevant what they're fighting about. They're just people trying to find some way to live together, and living together is inherently hard. And I guess I was really just taken with the way that this movie seems to sort of ask, and in some ways answer, the question, what decency do we owe to other people? And then it makes an argument that we sort of owe them a lot, that decency is important even when it's hard, and then further says, and sometimes it's really, really hard. And there's the Barry Keoghan character is really interesting here, because the Barry Keoghan character is sort of one step stupider and more annoying than the Colin Farrell character. And he, you know, he flirts with Carrie Condon, and she sort of politely lets him off, you know, and then, of course, spoilers, you've been warned, spoilers. Of course, he ends up dead, right, as a result of this. And the movie seems to be saying, you know, in some ways, look, we should be trying to be friendly with each other. We should be, in some ways, accepting of idiots who, you know, who try our patience. At the same time, we all know there's limits. There have to be limits. Barry Keoghan is the limit. He's actually like, and that's not wrong either. And so it's trying to find this space in which, well, on the one hand, we have to be nice to each other, even if we think we have better things to do, even if we think it costs us greatness in some sense. And on the other hand, well, maybe not to everybody, maybe not to the truly stupid, right? The truly irritating, right? And it just has this sort of nice nuance and texture to its moral arguments. And it's very human. Well, it's also quite schematic, right? It's quite play-like in its sort of in its structure, but it's really just kind of it's nicely observed, and it's also just gorgeous. I loved looking at this movie and all of these beautiful exteriors, especially after the last couple of years where with big Hollywood studios, but we've seen a shocking number of movies over the past couple of years where outside scenes are very clearly set on sets inside in a warehouse somewhere with like some plastic plants and like, you know, they brought in some dirt for Sandra Bullock to like stomp around on. No, this is a movie that's set, that was shot, not that obviously the island is not real, but was shot on a real island in a real place under real suns, or, you know, and you just, it just really, it's very affecting, and it makes for like, it's just so much more enjoyable to look at.
Yeah. I mean, it's a great movie for lovers of Irish woolens. It's also a movie that raises, I think, an interesting question, which is how much was being very handsome bad for Colin Farrell's career? Because he's wonderful in this. And part of it is that he's just sort of grown into his face, right? Like he is no longer pretty in the way that he used to be. And as a result, I think, you know, there's space for him to do more in an actorly way. And, you know, he was for a while like considered kind of like hot and messy in the Hollywood gossip ecosystem. And, you know, I just wonder if, you know, growing into a slightly more weathered face has allowed him to be seen a different way and do different things. And obviously he has, you know, an ongoing relationship with McDonough as an actor and as a director.
I think that's the big thing here, right? Is that he it's not just that he has gotten a little older and a little more weathered, right? It's that he has evolved from being a like big budget leading man in movies like SWAT or, you know, Daredevil, right? He's the second lead in that. To being a character actor. He is Martin McDonagh has given him the space to become essentially a character actor.
Although the three movies he's done with McDonagh, he plays either the lead or a co-lead and all right.
But it's not a big Hollywood movie lead. He is a leading man, but it is a, you know, a much more nuanced thing, which is great. Let me ask you guys a question. Do you think that Brendan Gleeson's request, Colm's request to be left alone, is unreasonable? Cutting off your own fingers, fine. We can. That's unreasonable. I'm asking the actual request to be left alone and left in peace and not be bothered by a person you don't want to be bothered anymore. Is that an unreasonable request, Peter?
It's totally reasonable. It's totally reasonable, but that doesn't mean that it's wise, and that doesn't mean that it won't have deleterious effects.
Well, I also think I'm going to give a slightly different answer. I think it is unreasonable given the circumstances, right? I mean, it is one thing to break off a friendship in a larger community in a city where you don't have to see the other person every day, where you and the other person are going to have alternate options for like social outlets, for places to go drink. But when your request disrupts an entire community and denies another person sort of social comforts and, you know, kind of comfortable access to other accommodations, then the sort of severity and totality of the request, I think, becomes unreasonable.
Well, but is that actually what happens? I mean, we see that they go to the same restaurants. They're still able to be in the same place together. It's not like Brendan Gleeson says to Colin Farrell, "You can never come within 50 feet of me." He just doesn't want to be talked to.
Yeah, but the sort of miasma of it is obviously disruptive in a wider way, right? It makes the barman uncomfortable. You know, you've got the priest like sort of curious and anxious about it. It creates this sort of constant frisson in a way that is unpleasant. And also, frankly, just like the guy keeps sending mixed signals, right? About like what he actually wants. There are times when he has like some level of contract with him and doesn't cut off a finger. And I mean, he's a bad friend.
My favorite scene in the movie, I think the sweetest, weirdly, scene in the movie, at one point, a police officer punches Colin Farrell out and Gleeson goes and picks him up and silently, you know, puts him in his cart, starts driving him home, and then gets out of the cart and is like, because the thing is, this is the thing about the movie. And what I find very interesting is that it's not like Brendan Gleeson's character hates Colin Farrell's character. Colm does not hate Patrick. He just doesn't want to be bothered by him anymore. And as a misanthrope, I have to say I'm very sympathetic to this point of view. This is why I'm trying to figure out how far I can go with these requests in my own life.
The movie is in some ways about this question, right? It's about misanthropy and despair, right? There's the whole conversation with the priest about how's the despair, right? That sort of hangs is sort of one of the movie's big questions sort of out in the open there. And again, this is why, you know, I think the difference between Alyssa's answer and mine is to some extent the thing that the movie is wrestling with. The movie is trying to say, well, look, Brendan Gleeson clearly finds this guy kind of annoying, and he would love to play, to make art and to spend his time well. Like, that's not crazy. That's not unreasonable. But it's also saying that there's consequences to that sort of, honestly, to that sort of selfishness and to that sort of thing, which isn't a sin, but isn't very nice now, is it? Right? As the priest says. And it is trying to wrestle with the fact that you can make a totally reasonable request that says, look, I'm going to try and bring something new into the world, right? There's that great little monologue about how, you know, 2 weeks ago there was no song, and then I wrote a part of the song and another part of the song, and then there was a new song. I created something. What was that worth? Was that worth what effectively starts a little miniature war between these two people, one of whom is kind of dim, maybe isn't bringing that much to the world? At the same time, it ends up being quite disruptive to the island, to the two men's lives, you know, to their property, to their no other human dies except unless we count the war that's already happening that they're not really part of, but, you know, to their animal friends. And it's a movie that sort of says, well, look, you can be not nice. That's okay, and we can even understand why you might not be nice. But if you're going to choose to not be nice to people, then it will cost something, and it will hurt, and there will be social and individual and personal consequences.
Fair enough. All right, so what do we think? Thumbs up or thumbs down on The Banshees of Inisherin? Peter?
Loved it. Thumbs up.
Alyssa?
Thumbs up for, you know, fine Irish woolens and acting.
Thumbs up. I liked it a lot. I think this movie is, it is his best film since In Bruges by far. I don't think it's quite as good as In Bruges, but it is his best film since In Bruges for sure. All right. That is it for this week's show. Make sure to swing by atma.thebulwark.com for a bonus episode on Friday. Make sure to tell your friends. Strong recommendation from a friend is basically the only way to grow podcast audiences. If we don't grow, we will die. If you did not love today's episode, please complain to me on Twitter @SunnyBunch. I'll convince you that it is, in fact, the best show in your podcast feed. See you guys next week.